Welcome to Magical Musings with Brian and Joy. I hope everybody out there is having a good time. Happy Samhain. I hope your Samhain holidays were good and that your Thanksgiving holidays, if you celebrate that, were good. This is Magical Musings episode number 8. And we're privileged to have Galina Krasikova, author of The Northern Tradition, speak to us tonight about the Northern Traditions. So, Galina, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show, both of you. I'm really looking forward to this. My name is Galina Krasikova, and I've authored a number of books on the Northern Tradition and on polytheology. I'm a polytheist. I'm heathen, which means my primary devotional relationships are to and for the Norse gods. I specifically follow Odin. I'm owned by Odin. And I have a strong devotional relationship with several other Norse deities, Sigyn, Loki, Freya, and our moon god, Mami. So my primary focus right now is teaching people to develop an organic and healthy devotional practice, and also spreading the word about the importance of ancestor veneration. I don't know what else you want me to say. I have a master's in religious studies from NYU, and I'm currently doing a PhD in classics.
Oh, excellent. That sounds very cool. It sounds like you've been around for quite a while and seen pretty much everything, huh?
I would say that would be pretty accurate.
Actually, I read your Exploring the Northern Tradition several years ago when I was like kind of considering the idea of becoming Ausatru and heathen myself, and I found it to be a really interesting book. I mean, more recently, I picked up Northern Tradition for the Solitary Practitioner, wanting to refresh my memory about, you know, your writing and your work, and, you know, it's kind of exciting to be able to actually talk to you directly.
Yeah, BNP.
At least not much. I think that Northern Tradition for the Solitary Practitioner is the more important book. Exploring the Northern Tradition is a very basic introduction to what the Northern Tradition is all about. And I'm using Northern Tradition as an umbrella term for all of the various religious restorations of pre-Christian, polytheistic, indigenous, Scandinavian, Germanic religion. Technically, it's a slippery term because technically we could also be talking about the Celtic and the Sami traditions, but I want to just come right out and say that when I use the term and the way that it tends to be used within heathenry, it refers only to the Norse and Germanic. So I think that the Exploring the Northern Tradition is a very basic introduction to what this body of traditions is all about. It's a less popular book, but I think that Northern Tradition for the Solitary Practitioner, which I co-wrote with Raven Caldera,
that goes into
the meat of devotional practice. And for me, and the way that I teach and the way that I practice, that's where it's all about. I mean, regardless of what gods you follow or what tradition you're practicing, it's that devotional practice, that ongoing everyday choice and conscious mindfulness and mindful veneration that's the heart of the practice.
Well, and definitely. I mean, I was really struck by the depth to which you go in Northern Tradition, for the Solitary Practitioner, because you're dealing with like prayers and what I actually really liked about it was the fact that you've got like this sort of outline for prayer beads, which, you know, it's not something a lot of folks in the Northern Tradition think of when they, you know, want to enhance their practice or their, you know, personal devotional work.
No, and they're wonderful. I mean, for some people, particularly if they come from a birth religion that utilizes prayer beads, these things are very instinctive. They're very tactile reminders that, okay, now I'm going to spend this time and focus on the gods that I love. Some days, I mean, that may be all you can do. I pray extempore a lot, but there are days when I am tired and sick and stressed where the best that I can do is pick up a set of prayer beads and default to these set prayers that I've created or that have been created for me for use with these beads. And they're wonderful mnemonic devices, and you can take them anywhere. And we're such tactile creatures. Humans are creatures of the sensorium, sight and sound and smell and taste and above all else, touch. And I think that, you know, I know what I learn. If the more of these things that I incorporate into my learning practice, the more that I'll remember something, and the more deeply that thing will be integrated into my daily awareness. And I think it's the same thing when you apply that to devotional practice. There's something very special about these tactile things. That's why altar work, you know, setting up a shrine, setting up an altar is so important.
Yeah, and that's something that really needs to be explored more in depth. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that say they want to set up a shrine but don't really know how to go about it. Is there something special in setting up shrines and altars in the Northern tradition?
I find that people who come from a Protestant background have far more of a problem with setting up altars mm-hmm. and shrines than people who come from a Catholic background. I have a friend, her name is Marianne, and she's an amazing photographer. She's a fairly well-noted Hudson Valley photographer. And we talk about this sometimes because one of her interests is traveling and photographing images of the Virgin Mary and devotional shrines and these little roadside shrines that spring up where someone has died.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, once she said, I was raised Protestant. We didn't have any of this. And it really got me thinking. There's a real difference in the way that religious life is approached between the Protestant and the Catholic. And then there you have different flavors of Protestantism and flavors of Catholicism on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the influence of the Protestant Reformation, where you basically had the destruction of altars. There's a wonderful book called The Stripping of the Altars by Eamon Duffy that I highly recommend to any of our listeners today. It talks about the influence of the Protestant Reformation on folk religion. And I think that, you know, while it may seem that I'm going a bit off topic, I think that given that certainly in heathenry, the majority of converts are converting from Protestant Christianity,
mm-hmm.
that the idea of setting up an altar that speaks to the sensorium, well, it's very foreign. I mean, at least if you come from Catholicism, there may be problems and there may be other issues with which you have to contend, but the idea of having a lush, devotional, visual life, icons and images and statues and candles and this and that, and knowing how to incorporate that into the day-to-day minutiae of veneration,
right.
It's much more natural. You've grown up with it. It's something that you know how to place in your devotional life. So I encounter a lot of people who want to do an altar or a shrine, and they're afraid, or they don't know how. And I've seen sad little shrines where it's like a statue and maybe a flower, and you're lucky if there's a flower there. And I'm like, oh, baby, no, no, no. Make it beautiful. You are creating a visual representation of your welcome to these gods and powers into your life. Make it lush. Make it beautiful. But it takes practice. I mean, I've taken to posting a lot of photos of various altars from my house events
mm-hmm.
or from people who are people send me pictures, students or friends or colleagues will occasionally send me pictures and allow me to post them, or photos that I've taken myself. I've taken to posting pictures of various altars on my blog simply so people can see what's possible, because I had to learn. I mean, you know, we learn and we develop and we grow, and it's good to have examples. I mean, I had very, very good devotional models growing up.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case with everyone. And I think that if that's not the case, and because that's not the case, there's a learning curve, and that learning curve can be steep.
Yeah. What is your blog address, just so that people can find it?
Sure. It's kraskova.weebly.com. Weebly is Weebly. Kraskova.weebly.com.
And if you're listening to this off of our website, that is going to be linked in the description for this episode. So, yeah, find that and go there. This is going to be a little hard to explain. You were saying that you're using the Northern tradition as an umbrella term. Are there specific pantheons that you're dealing with? I mean, I know the Norse is probably in there, but do you add like the Finnish and other pantheons in there?
When I talk about the Northern tradition, the way that I use that term is the way that basically it has come to be used within the heathen community. It implies veneration of the Norse gods, Odin, Loki, Frigga, Freya, Thor, et al. There are many different denominations that fall under that rubric. I mean, look at Christianity. There's no one Christianity.
Mm.
You got Baptists, you got Lutherans, you got Catholics, you got Mormons, and some of them would say that the others weren't Christian and all the infighting, different denominations. This is just what happens. And the same is true in heathenry. Like Alpha True is one particular denomination. Northern tradition, paganism, is something else. And you have different, other different denominations as well. So it's not a cohesive unit. I'm using it as an umbrella term, very much the way I might use paganism as an umbrella term for polytheistic religions in general.
Okay. Are there any other names to the other types of... I don't know how to say this.
There are multiple restoration and reconstructionist religions. I mean, there's Canaanite polytheism, there's Hellenic polytheism, Roman polytheism, Romulo, which is the indigenous paganism of Lithuania.
Well, no, yeah, for those, that's a whole nother show. I'm talking about specifically with the northern stuff. Do you know?
There are different denominations.
No, I'm not sure what you're asking. Okay, I'm not being clear. You said that there are the different denominations in the Northern Heathenry. What are some of the other denominations' names, if they have them, is what I'm pretty much asking.
No, that's fine. There's Forn Save there, which focuses more on continental religion.
Okay.
Specifically Scandinavian. There's heathenry, which is just a broad term for someone who venerates the Norse gods rather
right.
than a denomination in and of itself. There's Alpha True, which follows a more Icelandic model. I'm blanking. There is a denomination of heathenry that is focusing specifically on Pennsylvania ditch culture and folk practices and veneration of the Germanic gods.
Oh, is that the one that Silver Ravenwolf does, the Hex Mastery?
Yes, I think so. And I, for the life of me, and I apologize if anyone of that denomination is listening, I'm blanking on its name. Northern paganism, which puts far more emphasis on personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Than on lore or strict reconstruction. And then there are every space in between these points on a map.
Okay.
You'll find that people may fall. Those are the ones that come to mind off the top of my head.
Oh, it's fine.
The important thing is that you know that heathenry is not a monolithic unit.
Okay.
But there are many different approaches. And this mirrors the world of our ancestors. Prior
mm-hmm.
to the coming of Christianity. I mean, you had tribal units and the emphasis within each region and tribe and amongst different social classes would be very different.
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay, Brian, you've tried to ask something about 5 times now.
That's just normal. I've kind of been thinking, actually, about how there's kind of like a mystical element that, you know, you kind of address in your books that isn't generally practiced in the Northern tradition. It seems to be very exoteric. You know, it's like focused on the group experience, the, you know, that passing the horn in a whole, you know, crowd.
Yeah, I think it's absolute crap. I think that's actually, it is to our shame as a religion. I think this comes from a very Protestant Weltanschauung that has crept into the religion. I think that focus on the passing the horn and these incredibly rigid and unemotional rituals where you do everything you can to keep the presence of the gods at bay is absolute crap. if there is no experiential component to your religion, if you have not had the experience of laying yourself down before the presence of your gods, trembling and pissing and shitting and laughing and singing in absolute ecstasy, then we're doing something wrong.
Oh, that's good.
Lady after our heart. We've been saying this a little bit.
Yes, swearing is very normal on our show.
This is one of the major ideological fault lines in contemporary heathenry. And I absolutely base it on the fact that it's a very Protestant idea. So is the fetishization of what the heathens call the lore. Medieval manuscripts like the Poetic Edda, written 200 years after the conversion to Christianity of Iceland, things that were never, ever, ever intended to be utilized as religious texts, but they come from Christian religions that venerate a holy book, that fetishize a holy book, and they bring that right into heathenry. It's crap. And it's going to be the death of the religion.
Wow. Get a little excited about it. Gosh, there's some emotion.
No, that totally doesn't make sense.
If you can't get passionate about proper service and veneration to your gods, then what do you get passionate about?
That's what
I say to people. This is what's important. I have been faulted because I put veneration to the gods above veneration to the community. And I'm like, absolutely. Because when you are properly honoring your gods and ancestors, everything else falls into place in the community is in hand.
Oh, absolutely. I was being sarcastic.
Preaching to the choir, I'm sure.
No.
Very firmly.
Oh, it's fine. No, well, Brian and I have been saying stuff like this for a while on several other shows. That, you know, if you're in circle, in your ritual, in your temple, and you don't feel something, you're doing it wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. Why are you doing it? If you are unwilling to open yourself up to the experience of the sacred, however that may manifest for you, then what are you doing? If you don't want to encounter your deity, because you don't even believe that these deities exist, what are you doing? Go away.
Go, Brian.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking about it, like, because there is, it seems to me that modern paganism in general just becomes so focused on, like, group rituals and formality and all this kind of stuff that, you know, there is that loss of the mystical, the direct experience.
In the modern reconstruction, I seriously question whether it was ever there. I think that half the time you have people who are ill-trained in ritual work, because it does take training, who are doing shoddy rituals, who will do anything to avoid having an experience that will shake up their nice, pat little world. Direct experience with the sacred is terrifying. Our ancestors knew this. Read Tacitus. Read about the account of ritual to the goddess Nerthus in a sacred grove, where if you fell while you were entering the grove, you stayed on your hands and knees, out of respect for the power that was present. You know, I hear heathens talking about how they'll never bend their knees to any power in the universe. I'm like, deity shows up. Yeah, you will. I have been in the presence of deities. I have sensed that numinous, and you go down. I think that the reason that it's so absent is, one, you have people who don't know what the hell they're doing as ritual leaders. My partner had posted something on his blog recently, where he linked to a couple of articles where people were talking about how to bring the mystical back into ritual. There's nothing mystical about what they were writing. What they were describing was competent ritual practice. I'm like, wow, if that's mystical to you, y'all, you know, we're screwed.
Ah, those fluff bunnies.
A lot of healing rituals put the center of their ritual, they put the people and the community at the center of their ritual. It's not about the gods, it's about the people. And I have a problem with that. I mean,
well,
I don't think that is the right priority.
And I think, too, that when the focus is limited to the community and to group rituals and stuff, you end up with a very exclusivist, you know, culturist, almost racist religion. And I think that kind of is the root of where the negative attitudes toward heathenism and, you know, Ausatru and all the others comes from, really, is because they're so fixated on the group ritual, on who's allowed to be part of the group, and, you know, isolating themselves as a reconstructionist group, that they tend to forget devotion to the gods and the resulting experiences that are supposed to change you as a person.
I agree. But I think that we're talking about two different things. I think there's too much racism in contemporary heathen, and it kills me to say that. It kills me to say that. And I didn't think that there was until the movie Thor came out, where they have the god Heimdall being played by a black actor who's amazing. I love Idris Elba. He's phenomenal in the role. I started watching the responses of people on various email lists and the degree of white privilege and hostility and racism that was coming out sickened me to my soul. So I think that there's that. But I also think that putting the community first means that you're not having a sacred experience. It leads to humanist paganism. It leads to a worldview where you yourself are the highest thing in the universe. It leads to the exact opposite of a sacral devotional reality. That's what I think it leads to. I think I agree that I've seen both things that you describe, but I think they come from two different streams. And as to the racism, I fight it. Whenever I see it, I call it out. I think that people have taken the idea of honoring their ancestors and they've screwed it up. I say honor your ancestors because it is foundational. It is fundamental. We all have ancestors. And as the Lithuanian proverb goes, the souls of the dead are the protection of the living. But you know what? You trace that back far enough and all those ancestors go to Africa.
It's true.
True, yeah.
Very true.
So the things that people take what is a very sacred and very necessary thing, venerate your dead. And instead of using that to understand the commonality of the human experience and the fact that we can all trace our line back to mitochondrial Eve, this magnificent African woman who, 100,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago, gave birth to the world. Instead of doing that, they look at it and they say, well, my ancestors are people like me. My ancestors, they look at it and they focus on race. They focus on skin color, or they focus on culture in an exclusivist way. And I think it's one of the wounds of our contemporary world.
Yeah. And I was...
It's a very racially divided world, and I think that it's a lack of awareness of that, mm-hmm. and maybe a little bit of fear, and just an incredible lack of awareness.
No, and this was one of the things that I was going to ask you about, because there's, a lot of criticism that I know of on open pagan boards of Asatru and several other northern traditions like Theodish belief, and it's very critical of the racism, and it questions, whether this is a good tradition or not. So
racism doesn't come from the tradition. The racism comes from modern men and women who misunderstand the tradition. When it shows up, and I want to just say that any heathen worth his or her salt will call that shit out where it's found. Most good heathens are horrified to find that in any avenue, in any branch of their tradition.
Well,
this
I was...
Something, so I just want to make that clear.
It's absolutely wonderful.
It doesn't come from the tradition. Our ancestors weren't like that. You look at the stories of our gods, and they're intermarrying all over the place. It was not an issue.
True. Yeah.
Where it comes an issue is in a post-doctrine of discovery world where race was used to support genocide, colonialism, and slavery, and a modern world where we haven't dealt with any of that because we're so fucking afraid that the question of reparation, rightful reparation, might one day come up.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm in a mood now. I need to go with this for a while. So much of the work that I do. When I teach ancestor work, I warn people. I'm like, you're going to encounter two ancestral wounds. And you're going to have to look at them. And you're going to have to sit with them because this is a human problem. It's not a white problem. It's not a black problem. It's not a brown problem. It's a human problem. You're going to have to first look at the fact that your ancestral traditions were destroyed by the spread of monotheism across Europe. There was a genocide. Your traditions were destroyed and some of your ancestors collaborated. Then you have to look at what happened after that, how our ancestors perhaps of necessity, perhaps in some type of perverted cultural Stockholm syndrome, drank that poison and became the monster that came across the ocean and became the devourer and destroyer of nations. And
wow.
We have yet.
I like it.
Oh, my goodness. Preach it, sister. We hit a button. It's a big red button.
actually,
and
going back
very
to the whole...
with who I've taken to House Sankofa. I mean, going back to the question of you said before of exclusivity, I do not have an open door policy for my house. I am interested in working with people who want to venerate their dead and honor the gods. Nothing else before that. So I would not, for instance, welcome a quote-unquote atheist pagan into my rituals. Why would I, and why would they want to be there? I was very wary of them.
Well, if you don't have a god that you're praying to.
I would not have a racist present in my house. They'd be likely to get themselves bodily thrown out. Well, I would not have someone who held those views in my house. And one of the things, I am a product of this culture too, and one of the things that I pray about constantly to my ancestors is root this out of me. Bring it to my awareness, because I know that I grew up in this culture, and I grew up right on the border between North and South of this country. So I know that there's got to be some poison in there somewhere. Root it out. Slap me in the face with it so that I have to look at it, deal with it, and get rid of it.
Outstanding.
I pray every day for that, because if I am racist, I am dishonoring my dead.
Well, and I think, too, that when you look at any of the polytheistic cultures throughout history, I mean, you're looking at cultures that weren't necessarily exclusive or racist-minded. You've got, like, Celts who moved into, like, Turkey to trade, or was it, no, I guess it was the Vikings or something that moved into
You don't see race being, racism, race as we know it today and as we define it today, is post-doctrine of discovery. It is not something, it was not like this. I'm not saying that our polytheistic ancestors were angels, they weren't. They were warlike, bloody, and violent, just like we are today.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't the concept of race as an exclusionary, xenophobic thing did not exist. No more than the concept of sexual orientation did, by the way. These are very modern categories, you know. And part of that is some of the influence of the scientific revolution that wants to categorize everything. But a huge part of it is the influence of the doctrine of discovery. You have to
and
make
actually,
someone edible.
Sorry, Galina, you do bring up a good point, though. With the concept of sexual orientation, I mean, how does
heathenry
and northern tradition...
In the ancient world, sexual orientation, as we know it, didn't exist. You could have sex with anyone you liked, but whether it was socially appropriate depended on your status, it depended on your gender, it depended on what role you took. Sex in the ancient world was all about power dynamics.
Yeah, that's very true.
Craig Williams, Professor Craig Williams. I think it's called Roman Homosexuality, and it's very much worth reading because the concept didn't exist. It was all about power dynamics, which is very interesting. You didn't start seeing this rabid categorization until the modern age. Like you know, you could do whatever you wanted. You were still expected to marry and have children.
And that's kind of the interesting thing to me because, I mean, you can look at that same issue cross-culturally and there's it's very much a power dynamic. It's you know, men can have sex with each other, but the one who's made fun of is the guy who took the bottom role, you know. It's all very weird, but it's so lightheartedly conceived of. Like, nowadays it's a very categorized, you know, formal... Here's a label, and this is how you're going to live by, you know,
we set
labels.
We do have our labels. I think that the amount of transphobia, homophobia, and buried misogyny in contemporary American heathenry is monumental. But I don't think, again, that's not something that comes from the heathen tradition as a whole. That's something that comes from our culture. A culture deeply influenced by Protestant Christianity, a culture deeply influenced by fundamentalism. The threads of the American religious experience are saturated with fundamentalism from the moment the Puritans came across the water. It is a defining factor of the American religious experience. Even as secularism, we say America is a secular country, but look at France, which is also a secular country. They're very different. Secularism in America is deeply informed by a somewhat fundamentalist Protestant Christianity. That's where I lay. It's those social threads, that social fabric, and American cultural fabric, that's where I lay the threads of some of these things that are cropping up in heathenry. It's just that people don't have any good models or guides or mentors or elders because we are a broken tradition. We're reconstructing. We are not reconstructed. We're still in the process of restoration. So they don't have good models for working through some of this when they convert.
And the models that they do have are probably slanted in favor of what they're trying to fight against, too, because, I mean, Christian monks were the ones that wrote it all down, you know, so.
Well, there are models out there. They just slander and attack them.
Yeah.
You know, now, there are people doing the work in the community, but the ones who are doing really focused work and hitting a lot of these issues and working to develop a religion steeped in devotion are getting attacked, myself included.
Well,
and we're getting attacked not because of our theology. We're getting attacked on the basis of our gender. We're getting attacked with sexual threats. We're getting attacked with threats of violence. We're not getting saying, I disagree with you, blah, 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 blah. It's I disagree with you, and you have horrible morality, and you should get fucked by a horse, which someone actually said to me.
Oh, my God.
Or you should have a gun stand taken upside the head. My partner found a whole conversation on Facebook by good, upstanding, out the truth, who were talking about how I should be sexually assaulted because of the theological position I hold. Now, you tell me that isn't misogyny, because were I a man, those comments would never have been made. It would have been more likely to have stuck to the issue.
True.
This is what the people who speak out are faced with, if they're female, if they're gay, or if they're trans. And right now, the people that are getting tapped to speak out, the people that are getting snapped up by their gods, tend to fit those categories.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's a bad situation in some places.
Yeah,
but again,
sounds like it.
This is not the tradition.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm a little stunned here because what you're saying is it hits kind of close to home for me, at least, because I'm trans myself. So it's kind of like, wow. All right. Well, having delved into all of that and
well, actually, I would sort of like to inquire about your views on, like, the afterlife and kind of sort of more esoteric elements of the Northern tradition, because I think we can go into the whole problem of power dynamics and you know, cultural influence and, you know,
totally lost.
Any sort of hidden levels of hate in every pagan path. But, I mean, tangents are great.
I'll do something that's not going to get me all fired up.
Well, Joy and I love tangents, and we go on, you know, all kinds of wandering ones all the time.
And the standing joke is that we always relate it back to tarot. So this relates to tarot.
Probably does somehow. Nonetheless, yeah. I mean, let's look and talk about, you know, some of the other aspects of the faith that, you know, can touch on.
Yes. Because that was great. But, yeah, do tell us a little bit more about...
I had a moment.
Do tell us more about the theology and the worldview and the cycle of life, death, and rebirth or whatever.
Well, I'd be happy to. I think that there is a commonality in polytheism across the board. I'm not saying that all polytheisms are the same. I'm saying that there are certain points that you find in pretty much all indigenous religions. And they're found in heathenry as well when it's done well. Honor your ancestors. The souls of the dead are the protection of the living. We stand on the shoulders of our dead. Honor your ancestors. Honor those that came before you. Honor your gods. Honor the holy powers. And respect and venerate the spirits of the land around you. We're animists. The world is alive. The world is sentient.
Mm-hmm.
Those three things put you in right relationship with all of the many holy powers around you, and that translates into building a better community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that people often think as a heathen that I'm, you know, because of my strong devotional stance, that I'm anti-community, and I'm not. I think that by being in right relationship with the powers, we build the strongest community possible.
Mm-hmm.
If you are honoring your ancestors, how can you do that and neglect your descendants? How can you do that and neglect your neighbor? How can you honor your ancestors and be spitting on building strong community ties? I mean, it carries forward. So I think that regardless of what denomination you fall into, ancestors, holy powers, gods and goddesses, and the land, the spirits of the land, are fundamental. Those are the three key points. Everything else revolves from that. And of course, the elemental powers are our eldest ancestors. Norse cosmology says all creation began with a big bang. It began when the world of fire and the world of ice, two conflicting forces, crashed together. And from that conflagration, existence came into being. So these are our eldest ancestors too. And there's a radical interconnectedness if you really look at theology as it's presented in the fragments that have come down to us, and as it spins out in actual practice. We believe in something called weird, which underlies everything. It's the threads that bind everything together. It's causality and consequence. Every decision you make, every decision you don't make, becomes a thread of weird that is laid down, and it intersects with the threads of weird created by everyone else. This is Ur-Law. This is something that even the gods have bowed their heads before. We believe in an afterlife. Where you go depends on which god you venerated. It depends on your conduct. It depends on many things, and it might include reincarnation. Some people believe that you reincarnate down your ancestral line. Some people believe that you just reincarnate. Which is interesting, because if you as a friend of mine, a colleague, and an elder once pointed out, if you reincarnate down your ancestral line, and you're venerating Great Uncle Leo, and you're really the reincarnation of Great Uncle Leo, then any veneration that you do for him strengthens you now. So it's really kind of mind blowing.
That's a wild point.
It is. I just can't think about it because it makes my head hurt. We have a world tree, Yggdrasil, which supports all of creation, and nine sacred worlds, worlds of gods, worlds of elemental powers, a world of the dead. You know, there are nine sacred worlds, and in the center of all of that is the human world.
Mm-hmm.
So in no way are we seen as separate from the rest of creation. We're ensconced in it.
I was just going to comment. It's always been very interesting to me that there, the different cultures that all have trees and venerate trees. You got the northern tradition with Yggdrasil. You've got the Druidic traditions with the tree that binds the land, sea, and sky together. You've got the Tree of Life in the Kabbalah, and they all seem to kind of interrelate to each other. And I find that kind of interesting. Do you want to say anything about that? Or
our ancestors knew things. I read anthropological texts where you have anthropologists marveling that in four or five different cultures that never had any contact with each other, the shamans or the spirit workers or the medicine people would be using the same herbs in the same way. Like, how did they figure it out? I'm like, well, dumbass, maybe the spirit of the plant told them.
Either that or experimentation. I mean,
Yes.
Right.
Once enough people die, you
learn something poisonous. Our ancestors had to be much more aware of the world around them, both the spiritual world and the physical world.
Well, yeah.
We have a long history.
I think, too, that because part of the whole concept of having an animistic worldview, you know, your spiritual tradition rises from the ground beneath you as opposed to coming down from heaven as a revelation. You know, you're connected with plants.
And Judaism has its tree of not only the tree in Kabbalah, but, you know, the tree of good and evil, the tree of knowledge.
There is that one, too.
Prominent motif. You see it in Sumerian lore. There's a fragment of a Sumerian text that talks about Inanna going to the Halupu tree from which her throne would later be made. So it is a dominant trope, and I'm like, it's useful technology.
Definitely.
And navigating the world and the spaces between the sacred and the very, very human, which is not unsacred, but it's different.
Well, that's true. One thing that I wanted to have you explain for the listeners more than anybody else is you mentioned back at the beginning that you were owned by a deity. Could you elaborate and explain on that a little bit more?
Yes, I have a very, very intense devotional relationship with Odin. He is the reason that I actually came into heathenry. And I'm owned by him. I'm a shaman and a spirit worker, and part of that is being taken up and given over to, in my case, to Odin.
What?
It means pretty much exactly what it says. I am his working tool.
Okay, it sounds a little bit like... Well, it sounds a little bit, I mean, when you talk about owning and you add people into it, it starts sounding like slavery in a little bit.
I have referred to myself as God's slave before, and there is historical precedent. And that's one of the reasons, and this is something in my work that arouses a great deal of controversy, but I'll often liken it to a 24/7 DS relationship.
Interesting.
This is what happens with Northern tradition shamans, and it's what happens in more than just the Northern culture. You are taken up and you are owned. Flat out owned by the gods and spirits you serve. Now, that is not an everyday devotional relationship.
No.
I'm a spiritualist. That is something that is part and parcel of what I do and the role that has been given to me to fulfill. It's not that I'm saying that every single person who wants a devotional relationship with Odin is going to end up a god slave. I'm not saying that at all. There are thousands and thousands of ways to serve the gods. What I'm saying is that this is what defines my relationship with him, and it's joyous. I mean, it varies. Sometimes the relationship is, you know, people hear God slaves, and I think their minds go very unpleasant places. But this is a relationship of over 20 years, and it's one that has many, many different facets. And on my end, it's intensely fulfilling, even when it's vexing and agonizing, which it can be. Sometimes the relationship is intensely personal and intimate. Sometimes it's more like a military commander to a subordinate. Sometimes it is more remote. Sometimes it is as though I am a glove on his hand. It depends. I mean, it's not always one thing. And I think, no more than any relationship is always one thing. We're multifaceted. And I think that even more so, that holds true for the gods. But with traditional shamanism, of the northern variety, there's quite often that ownership component.
I bet you've been awakened like at 2:30 in the morning, told to get into full ritual regalia and go here, and then 2 hours later you're told to just go home, and nothing happened, haven't you?
No, because I'm usually not asleep at 2:30 in the morning. I get about 3 hours of sleep a day, or maybe 5 if I'm lucky.
Oh, Lord, I'm sorry. No, that's one of those, the reason that I
used
that.
I would have way. Yeah. I like to be kept busy. I think somewhere as a child I must have heard the phrase that idle hands are the devil's playground, and I kind of took it to heart. I do best when I am busy to the point of breaking. So I don't mind. But yeah, he keeps me hoping.
The reason that I mentioned it is because that was an example that we used in another show about a very intimate relationship with deities, and you just, you know, described it perfectly there.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, you don't need to know why. Your job is to do it. Once you have entered into that relationship and you have committed, and obviously that presupposes that there's a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And there's trust, and there's communication, then your role is to do your damn job.
Yeah, and, you know, it can be very vexing and can be very hard, but there's the rewards of always having somebody with you that's your greatest cheerleaders, too. And I find that is more than enough reward for, you know, doing something along those lines.
The work is the reward. I wouldn't say that Odin's my greatest cheerleader. I would say that Odin is a very effective drill sergeant. I very much think the work isn't about me. I do my job, and I enjoy a job well done. I enjoy being useful. I think the reward for me comes in being useful. And I make sure that I don't do anything in my personal life, my devotional life, to render myself not useful. That's
sounding, sounding a little bit more, the relationship. I know that in Muslim beliefs that they are slaves of God. And I found in The 13th Warrior, the movie, at one point, the main character was asking Allah to make him the best servant that he could be, the best representative of him, just before he went into battle. And it was just...
Yeah, that's a prayer that we should all be saying. Make me the best. Let me do this as best I can. Let me be the best servant of the gods that I can be.
And I found
that,
yeah.
I think that we should strive to be so much better than what we are. I mean, I don't do enough for my gods.
Hmm.
You know, I don't do enough for my gods. I've heard heathens say that, oh, well, don't give too many offerings now. You don't want to give too much. And I'm like, are you breathing? Then you haven't given too much, because every time you draw breath, you should be grateful. This is an ongoing, what the Romans called, do ut des. I give in order that you might give. There's this ongoing reciprocity that we are constantly in their debt. And that has such a harsh sound in our culture, but it means that we exist, and it means that we exist in a web of reciprocity and gratitude. I love the two prayers that are given in 13th Warrior, because, and I like the Muslim prayer, because it says, make me a better servant of my God. Let me love you better. Let me serve you better. Let me open myself more to you so that I might know you better. You know, I can think of no better prayer.
And that puts me in mind of a saying that I've heard in at least a couple of places when I'm, you know, when I was looking at the Northern tradition myself. From the gods to the earth to us, from us to the earth to the gods.
I like that a lot.
Because there is that sort of mandate to live in a constantly reciprocal relationship with the gods and with the land beneath us. Like, it's not as much that we are stewards of the land, it is that the gods have given the land to us and all that it provides, and we do our very best to make the best use of those things that we can without exploiting and damaging and destroying them.
Yeah,
and obviously, you know,
I think we have such a debt to the land, such a tremendous debt to the land. I mean, look at what we do, and look at how mindlessly we do it. Look at fracking. No sane culture would do this. I think we have such a tremendous debt to the land itself.
Well, the comparison of us to a virus was very, very accurate, I thought, in The Matrix.
Oh, absolutely.
That's exactly how we act.
That man's got to produce some corrective action. We're not careful.
Yeah. I think that's what a lot of the modern diseases are, the ones that can't be killed, the antibacterial resistant bacteria and AIDS and all of those things.
Well, I've been criticized before for saying that the elemental powers are angry. They are. I think that we have our elemental powers who are responding as though they are under attack, as though they are being colonized. And you know what? They are. And the problem comes when humanity thinks of itself as the apex of existence instead of one part in a matrix.
Yep.
And unfortunately, that's where we're at, and that's the sickness, the soul sickness, with which all of us who are engaged in this restoration, one of many sicknesses, with which we have to contend.
Well, I think Chief Seattle put it really well when he said that man does not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it.
Absolutely. I hope.
Now, is that kind of like the concept of weird as well? I mean,
I would say it's deeply connected to weird, absolutely.
Because I was reading Brian Bates's The Way of Weird, also another great book I highly recommend.
I like it a lot.
And he talks about that too, you know, because, I mean, the basis of the story is that this monk, this scribe, is going to, you know, a heathen culture, and he's supposed to learn about their worldview and their gods and stuff, and he learns about the whole concept of weird and the weird sisters, and, you know, there are some shamanic elements into it as well, which I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, I would say that what we just described is definitely an aspect of weird. I mean, we are not separate from the spirits around us. You know, we cannot do with them whatever we want. There is causality and consequence. There are consequences for what we do and what we choose not to do. And these things, you know, I was watching a movie the other night with my goddaughter. It was just some silly movie, but, you know, it was cute. One of the characters said, when you do an act of kindness, it resonates in the world. And I think that that's very true, but I think that the opposite is also true. There are repercussions for the way that we walk in our world, good or bad.
Absolutely, and I think it's one of those things that you kind of have to learn to be aware of. I mean, most people just blindly stumble through life, you know, acting selfishly without even considering the possibility that what they're doing affects other people. And I think
I agree with you, and I think most pagans, unfortunately, I'm coming to the conclusion, stumble through life not aware that the deities about which they speak actually exist.
That's so counterintuitive, though. I mean, if you go into ritual and you're invoking the gods and deity decides to ride the priest or priestess, you know, there's absolute proof right there. And I think that's just
to you and to me and to anyone else, you know, to quote, with the ears to hear and the eyes to see. But I think that a lot of people have a huge investment in not hearing and not seeing. It's much safer if the gods are only aspects of your unconscious. You know, there was a whole blow-up on the Internet in the blogosphere in July of this past year. And it was an argument between pop culture and humanist pagans, who are generally non-theistic, and devotional polytheists. And it really highlighted a huge fracture in paganism as a whole. Do you believe the gods exist independently of your own mind, or do you believe that they're your creation? Or do you believe that they're just ideas or whatever? Well, obviously, I believe that they exist independently. I've had the experience. But a lot of people are deeply invested in keeping humanity at the apex of their devotional life. And I maintain that argument got so out of hand because when you criticize the humanist stance, when your entire worldview is predicated, your entire spiritual worldview is predicated on the centrality of the human, and somebody comes in and questions that, you're questioning self-definition. it's ugly in the community right now. I don't understand. I don't get it either. I mean, I have carried deities. I have seen them come down. I have felt them. I've interacted with them. It informs every single breath that I take. It informs my life. Not just how can you not see it, but why are you so deeply invested in not seeing it with evidence to the contrary, and why would you want to not see it?
Yeah,
because I think there is a very self-destructive willfulness in that stance.
Well, and I think that we live in a culture now that's become almost a cult of secularism, you know, and the idea that we fill our lives with random issues and causes that, you know, create separation between us instead of enhancing us in any real way. I mean, it becomes just like other conflicts that, you know, are meaningless and, you know, temporary, and it's just ways that we choose to distract ourselves from the real issue of, you know, the spiritual and, you know, I mean, the all-consuming spiritual life that we're, you know, that our ancestors would have easily led and never thought anything of it.
That's the thing. Our ancestors, I mean, some of them must be looking at us like, oh, my God, these people are not right. Because some of this we're reconstructing, and what that means is that we have this mental filter that we need to take down. That we have this way of looking at the world that's been deeply informed by this culture and by monotheism, which permeates this culture. And we have to confront that and deprogram ourselves. And that's terrifying, because there's always that space between tearing down the scaffolding with which you were raised and jumping into the unknown before you can root yourself in the restoration of your ancestral tradition. There's a gap there. There's an interstice that, and that's terrifying. What, you don't know what that's going to be like. And again, because we are in the process of restoration, we don't have an intergenerational network of community to reinforce everything that we could be.
Well, and I
mean,
if we were
growing up in an indigenous polytheistic culture, we would see our neighbors and our teachers and our friends and our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents venerating the gods and the dead and doing certain rituals. And there would be records and stories and moral lessons about how this was right and how this sustained the community.
Like you have in
but
Japan.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm half Lithuanian, and lately my Lithuanian ancestors have been very persistent. And they've been pushing me to do a lot of hearthkeeping. And I said, you know, I'm not overly domestic, so what's up? And what I was told is that you need, one, to experience what we experience as an act of power, as an act of sustenance, as a means hearth to hearth, household to household, village to village throughout the entire country, as something that sustained our people. It begins when you light the sacred fire in your own home with everything that entails, both at a mundane level and on a spiritual level. With each household, each person in each household is in right relationship with the gods and the ancestors and the power that powers, that radiates outward. That radiates outward, and it echoes in the world. And I just want to point out that Lithuania was the last country to be overrun by monotheism. They did not fall to the yoke of monotheism until the 15th century.
Wow.
So I listened to those ancestors.
It's a good thing, too. They might actually show up.
I didn't understand for a while, why are you pushing me to cook the traditional meals? Why are you pushing me to tend fire in a certain way? Why are you pushing me to do X, Y, and Z? Very simple, the basic things. And like, you must learn to keep a hearth. And this is not a gendered thing. This is a matter of making your community strong, that it starts with each individual person and with at each individual hearth. And it
that's
takes
actually
that mindfulness.
That's a very good point, actually. And it's something that they bring up in Hellenismos, modern Hellenic polytheism, is the idea that
Herodotus, and I on my house, the house that I work in, has a strong Hellenic thread.
Nice.
I work in a multi-traditional house, and one of the strong foundational threads is Greco-Roman. So
But I mean, you get my point, right, Galina? I mean, the whole idea of most of these polytheistic traditions is the idea of the foundation of life and spirituality coming from the hearth. And
it's not
an anti-woman thing, like a lot of people will, you know, tell themselves it is. You know, that's like telling women they have to be barefoot and pregnant. Well, no, it's not. What it's telling us is that life begins at home. Everything spreads from there.
And anything that you take out into the community, any ritual that you do publicly, should be a reflection of all the work that you have done at home, at your heart, and one-on-one in the dark, hard night of the soul when you are trembling before your God. And that's what's not present yet to any large degree in contemporary paganism, including heathenry. You know, this emphasis, I think in part this emphasis on community, ritual, community, ritual, community, ritual is a deep hunger for community. But I think also think we're going about it a little backwards.
Well,
yeah.
And I kind of think too that the whole idea with modern paganism is that it's been desperately for the real connections that our ancestors had to the gods and spirits. But because we don't have like a genuine, unbroken connection to their lifestyle, what we have is this, you know, literalist interpretation of, you know, what would have become holy scriptures instead of merely recorded stories.
People are using what they grew up with without examination. You have people coming from Protestantism, while the only devotional method that they generally had was reading the Bible.
Very true.
Holy Book. We want it. We want that which mirrors what we know.
And the high episcopagan.
Yeah, and this hunger for community is not bad, but I think that, I mean, but community flows from that right relationship with the gods and spirits. And that's the piece we're missing. We want to start with community and think that you can get there with that cohesive intergenerational unit. But that doesn't happen in the way that we're doing it. It starts one person at a time, one hearth at a time. And if all of that interiority of practice, if all of those personal and household devotions are lacking, then you don't have a community.
It puts me
and
in mind, actually.
And rituals are empty and frankly pointless.
Yeah, for sure. And it puts me in mind of the fear that people have of the whole concept of anarchy, because you get this fear that you go from, like, structure and order and the way things are, the status quo that we're familiar with, but there's this transition period that you have to go through before you can get to the other side. And everyone is terrified of that period because there is that disorganization, that lack of familiarity and comfort. But it's a means that leads to the proper end, right? And that's the whole idea with the idea of personal devotional work with the gods, personal experience with shamanism, etc. It's like the need to break down the familiar, the comfortable, and take us through the rabbit hole to what we can get on the other side, which is where we're supposed to be.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, when you go through something like that, if you were in an indigenous culture or tradition that was established, you would have elders to guide you through that. When I've initiated into one of the African traditions because Odin made me, you know? And that was a horrendously difficult emotional process for me, even though I love the Orisha dearly. But I had amazing elders to guide me through that. with all of the stuff that came up post-initiation, when I had to really reevaluate a lot of things or examine them, and personal things, not even religious, but personal things, I had elders to guide me through that. When terror or pain or whatever might come up arose, I knew that I could go to people who had been through this process and who were steeped in a tradition that is easily 10,000 years old, unbroken. And that is what we don't have. That's what was taken from us with the spread of monotheism. And this is not to say that there's anything wrong with Jesus or Allah or what have you. It's the monotheism piece of it that I think is very, very dangerous. And the way that it spread across Europe involved a religious and cultural genocide.
Well,
that's what we lost. And we haven't had it for so long that we don't even realize what's lacking. I mean, I knew it intellectually, but then to get dropped into initiation in a tradition that has not been severed, and to see it and experience it directly in action, that was life-changing for me. It's not just words when I say we are missing our elders. No, we are missing our elders, and it is devastating to us. That look at what happened in the United States with the destruction and the attacks on Native American tribes. In the late 1800s, through the better part of the 20th century, there was a governmental campaign to take Native children away, incarcerate them in, quote-unquote, schools, force them to convert to Christianity, forbid them to use their native tongue, and raise them up as Western men and women. But always they were, of course, secondary status. It was the destruction of a culture. You take one generation. It took one generation to destroy the continuity of cultural and religious transmission.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I have Native ancestry on my mom's side, and you know, I had relatives even, you know, until a few years back, who had been through the residential school experience and could tell you the stories of being abused and, you know,
absolutely
ridiculed for speaking their native tongue or for, you know, doing anything that was a tie to their native heritage and culture. You've got the repercussions of that now in
absolutely
efforts to reconstruct, like, rites of passage, you know, the spiritual life and traditions. And it's all based on, like, tidbits that they have remaining. But there, you can see kind of a taint of like, the colonialist and monotheistic influences in there. And so they're still working to get those out of there. But you can see a lot of the need for human beings. I mean, I guess in that sense, we're like trees. We need roots to grow and flourish. But without them, you know, we starve to death spiritually. You know, we wither and we die.
And all it took is it one generation. These things are not just transmitted by reading them in a book or practicing them yourself. They're transmitted by being surrounded by them, by having multiple generations that are modeling these right relationships. And we're a long way from that. I mean, I hear pagans arguing about whether or not they should raise their children in your faith. I'm like, well, you know what? Really? This is a question. Why is this a question? You know, we're not there yet. And this is the piece. Whether people, I really do think that it's this lack of intergenerational continuity, cultural and religious continuity, that I really think is at the heart of many of the struggles that you're seeing in the contemporary community, be it, you know, some type of paganism or some type of heathenry or very polytheistic reconstructions. I'm parsing terms perhaps a bit too much here, but this is a huge problem, and this is the problem that's underlying everything else. And that's why I tell people, when you honor your dead, sooner or later, we're talking about restoring and reconstructing our ancestral traditions. Sooner or later, you will ask, why do we have to do this? Where did they go? Why don't we have them? And think on those questions long and hard. There's a wonderful scholar, and I'm blanking on her name. There's a wonderful African-American scholar, and she's brilliant. And because I'm on the air now, I'm blanking on her name, but she said something that I found tremendously profound. The hardest aspect of colonization to get past is colonization of the image of God.
Hmm. That's profound.
Yeah.
That's true, actually. I mean, considering that most people, when they when they're asked, how do you envision God? Who is God? They'll describe an old geezer with a long beard on a throne and...
Or the white Jesus.
Outside, well, outside of, you know, like, northern tradition, who have Odin, I can't envision in my own head any other god that is a long-bearded, gray-haired old man sitting on any kind of a chair of any kind.
Jupiter,
I could
Saturn.
Point to the Canaanite tradition where you have the high god Ilu. It goes deeper than even the way that we perceive, that we might visualize God. It's how we approach God. It's how we engage spiritually. It's how we're patterned to look at the world. You know, I'm going to take a tangent for a second, but I promise all, it's relevant and I'll come back. I've had Christians come into my house, and I have 47 shrines in my home. So they're all over the place. It's not like you're going to miss them. I've had people come into my house, and the two cases that I'm thinking of, they were both very evangelical Christians. They can't see them. It's not that they look at them and think, oh, that's pagan and that's bad. They literally cannot see them. It does not register to their eyes as an altar. And I thought about that, and I thought that's a great metaphor, because with people who are coming into paganism, it's not that they don't want, I think, to do the internal work that will really root them in their traditions and open them up to their ancestors who can then guide them and step in and be those elders. Sometimes it is, but for a large extent, I think they can't connect the dots. It's not just that they don't connect the dots. I think a lot of us coming into this can't see the dots that need connecting. Like, I can look at what's happening in our world today, and, you know, I talk about breaking the filter, and I can track a lot of the issues in contemporary paganism and heathenry all the way back to the destruction of our ancestral traditions. And I can lay that at the feet of monotheism, and I can trace colonialism and racism and the genocide that we perpetrated in the Americas. I can trace that back to the doctrine of discovery. Most people, I don't think, can. I've encountered a lot of people where they just can't see the dots. And this is a fault of our culture. This is a fault of our educational system. This is a fault of the unspoken social indoctrination with which we all are raised. And it all needs to be challenged and broken down.
Okay. Well, given that, let me ask you this. Would one way to break all that down be ritual and doing the rituals?
I find that the best thing to do is to engage with your ancestors. If you can get right with your ancestors and really develop a deeply engaged ancestor practice, they will help you. They will do some of that work. They will help you get right with your gods. Because think about it, they got a vested interest in us not making this up. It reflects on them.
That's true.
Some of them have a debt. Some of those who you know, some of them have a debt. It's like, look. You, those of you who chose consciously to abandon your indigenous tradition, who chose to perpetrate atrocity, you owe us. So step forward and start making it right. And if you won't, you get nothing from me. I will honor those who will. And then I step forward and try to do what I can to make it better for the people that come after me. We have an obligation.
Okay, so take us, all of this aside, this has been a wonderful tangent and it's been very productive. Take us through your typical day.
Well, It depends. I'm in grad school, so my day varies somewhat. My typical day, Jesus.
Basically what I'm asking is, you've got a very integrated deity set into your life with the ancestors and with the shrines and everything else, and I want to see how that would relate to a normal, typical day.
Off the top of my head, I go to bed about 3 a.m. I'm up by 7 or 8. I make breakfast, I sit down in front of my ancestor altar, and I make small offerings, or I talk to them, or I touch base. I'm always consciously aware of how things are between me and the gods that I venerate. If I feel an imbalance, probably not in the morning because I'm not much of a morning person, but if I feel an imbalance anywhere or I feel a push, I'll do divination later in the day to see if something needs attending. I go to school. I teach Latin. I take my own classes. I do my work. I'm usually, when I'm not working or translating, I'm reading something or writing something that I've been pushed to write, or talking to my ancestors during the day, or I'll stop sometimes. I've been very blessed, very, very blessed. And most days throughout the day, there are those moments where I just stop and thank the gods, whoever I'm feeling. You know, in the evening when I come home is when I really get to work. I do like an hour of something artistic a day because it nourishes me. It's a gift from Oshun, and it nourishes me. So I either paint or I work on photography or I write. I do something. Mm-hmm. So when that's done, and I'll peck around at food sometime, you know, whatever. When that's done, I'll sit and pray. I have set prayers that I do for the Orisha every night. I have not set prayers, but just extempore conversation, that I'll go to my various shrines. I'll sit with Odin and meditate and pray. I'll make small offerings. I'll tend all the shrines. I will literally walk around my house and just make sure everything is in order. And I'll stop at the shrines, and I will offer prayers. I will do more for my ancestors, usually making them a meal in the evening. Depending on what ritual day it is, I will do larger offerings. Last night was the Numenia. It was the first day of the new moon. Now, my partner is a Greek polytheist, so we celebrate the Numenia together. So I cleaned most of my shrines. I'm going to say most because I cheated a little bit. I cleaned my house. For I cleaned it energetically. You know, I smoked it with this special blessing incense that I make. I took my kitchen table and I laid out a huge sheet most of which I made for certain gods and goddesses, because I had promised them that I would make a special offering on the Numenia. I sat down and did divination for the month to see if there was anything to which I need to pay special attention. And then I offered prayers and I said, and I prayed. And then I got up and translated 10 chapters of Latin because work doesn't stop.
Oh, goodness.
It depends. Sometimes I'll walk in my house and I will simply feel that a certain shrine needs tending. And then I'll go and I will pray to that deity and I will listen. What do you need? Sometimes I'll just get an internal push where I'll know this needs to be done. I'll confirm it with divination and then I'll get on with whatever work I have to do. At some point in the evening, I cook a lot, so at some point in the evening, I usually cook. That is a time when I commune with my ancestors. Lately, I've been making a lot of traditional foods. I have a lot of my grandparents' recipes, so I've been making traditional foods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a time when I do that, I will talk to my ancestors. The first slice of whatever I make goes to the house spirits. Another goes to the ancestors. Sometimes I'll honor the local mountain. I sleep in the belly of the mountain in the town where I live, so I'll go outside and I'll pour out offerings to the land spirits, to the city spirits, to the mountain spirits. Not every night, but often. If for some reason I'm not cooking for myself, usually I am making special offerings to two or three deities per night. Like on Monday, I might offer to the Norse god Mane, because the word Monday is the day of the moon, Moonday. Mm-hmm. It comes from his name. Mani's dog. So I might make offerings to Mani. And then Monday is also traditional. In one of the other traditions that I practice, I kind of straddle a couple because that's just how House Sankofa rolls.
Mm-hmm.
I make them after a break and I do something else, slip into Lukumi headspace and go and make offerings to Allegra. And then I'll go do something else, maybe some of my academic work, grade papers, whatever. And, you know, I'll sit and I'll actually just kind of feel things out. Like, do I need to spend time with any other deity? Usually at least once a month, my House Sankofa meets for a ritual, and we will do a celebratory ritual venerating various gods or goddesses. Like, we recently had a ritual where we on Veterans Day where we honored Odin and the military dead. I had intended it to be a ritual for Odin because I very strongly associate this time with him.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out it fell so close to Veterans Day that it was getting a really strong push that was then confirmed with divination that it needed to be focused very strongly on the military dead. I have certain obligations to the military dead. So, and I maintain a separate shrine to them. So that was our ritual. And we laid out offerings, and we spoke, and we prayed, and we chanted, we sang, we poured out more offerings, we prostrate ourselves before the altar, and we experience and whatever wisdom the dead wish to bestow. We have a Yule ritual coming up. We're doing it early this year. We're doing it in 2 weeks. And for that, I'm not quite sure. I don't have the whole ritual planned out yet. But one of the things that we're going to be doing, there was a recent thing, I think in Wisconsin, where an atheist student group set up a God graveyard. Had you guys heard of that?
I hadn't heard.
They had set up, in sight of the state legislature, on state university land, they set up tombstones with names of over 200 different deities, and that these deities were dead. I would note that they did not put the monotheistic deities. They only attacked those religions that they thought they could get away with attacking. So deities like Odin were listed, Dionysus, Hestia, Ogun, various Orisha and Loat, and it was incredibly offensive. And they attacked marginalized faiths. They spat in the face of all of their own ancestors who may have laid down their lives at some point to defend some of these traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, they ignored the actual fact that all of the deities they listed are still venerated. So it pissed a lot of us off. And moreover, I feel that corrective action needs to be taken. So at our Yule ritual, we have a list of as many of the names of these deities as we could find, and a couple of us have been researching to find appropriate prayers. We're going to divvy that list up, and we're going to make libations and offerings to each of the deities on that list.
Wow.
Interesting.
Normally, we do not ever mix traditions. If we're honoring Hera, we're honoring Hera in the appropriate Hellenic format.
Mm-hmm.
If we're honoring Odin, we're honoring Odin in the appropriate format. But in this case, I think it's a special case. So it depends. In October, we had an ancestor ritual where everyone brought pictures and tokens of their dead, and we set up a huge shrine, and we celebrated ritual and made offerings to our dead and told their stories and shared anecdotes and foods and drink and song and...
Yeah, sounds wonderful. You bring up a good point, actually, Galina. With the notion of, I mean, the fact is that we've created the barriers between different faiths. We've compartmentalized all of these different belief systems. And I think in a case like you mentioned, it's important for not just one particular faith group, but all of us to kind of come together and recognize that the hate doesn't just get directed at monotheism. The fact is, most groups that will try to create these kind of like political statements or whatever will use, pre-Christian gods. because they do feel they can get away with it.
Yeah.
Because there's not that massive representation through, like, organized bodies that will come to their defense.
Exactly. And it was offensive on so many levels. And more offensive that it occurred on state land in front of the legislature. When the university was contacted, as several heathens and pagans did, they gave non-responses. They brushed off the whole incident. And that was equally offensive. I had alumni of the university contacting me, apologizing for their university because I posted an article about this whole thing. You know, and I want to touch on something else. You know, you said we create the boundaries between faiths. We do. And I'm a polytheist first, and that means I venerate many gods. In the ancient world, that would have meant that I venerate the gods of my ancestors. If I venerate the gods of my partner and vice versa, I venerate the gods of the place in which I live. And then I might venerate gods and goddesses of whatever mystery cultus into which I initiated. There wasn't the xenophobia that you see in the contemporary community.
Hmm.
I think that that's partly because the communities are trying so hard to define themselves, and you can only be heathen you're not heathen if you don't only worship the Norse god. What is crap? I mean, come on, our ancestors were polytheists.
Well, I think what's interesting too is the idea that, like, if I can't remember where it was found, but there was some location, it might have been a Danish trading site somewhere, where they actually found, like, a bronze Buddha statue among the grave goods of a particular, like, chieftain or something. And it's like, well, you can speculate that he just had it because he'd stolen it and thought it was really cool. But there's always the possibility, too, that he actually was venerating, giving some attention to Buddha. Right, who existed 2,500 years ago. Like, the idea that there can only be a certain god being worshipped or a certain set of gods being worshipped by any one ancestor is weird, and, you know, it does create...
It presupposes that cultures weren't porous. It presupposes that there was absolutely no interaction or influence between cultures, and we know that wasn't true. I mean, that's simply not the way cultures work. There was a tremendous amount of interaction in the ancient world. I think my friend Tess Dawson said it best. She wrote a couple months ago that hospitality is best told not by how you treat your own gods, but by how you treat the gods of others. And I think that's very true. Like, you know,
absolutely.
I have said within Hans Sankofa, we have multiple traditions, religious threads, and we do. But we also have multiple protocols dictated by those traditions and those deities. And we are fluent in multiple protocols. And we do that not to pacify any human agency. We do that out of respect for the gods themselves. And when questions come up, we consult elders or we divine. You know, protocols with the gods are important, but I don't think they're meant to be divisive. I mean, just honor your gods. Honor. Better that you honor them. I mean, you know, they were never so separate. You look at the ancient world, particularly the ancient Mediterranean, and people were initiating all over the place. And you had Greeks worshiping Egyptian deities, and, you know, I mean, they never have this complete lack of communication between cultures. And where there's communication, there's sharing of knowledge and experience.
Well, I mean, you get, like, the whole cross-cultural interaction throughout the Middle East as well. I mean, you've got Alexandria, which was like a hub of, you know, multiple faiths and spiritual practices, and you've got, like, folks in Jerusalem worshiping, like, the Canaanite gods and so on, and people think that there was just this, you know, solid one god theistic belief system in Jerusalem and, you know, Palestine.
That's
but when you really look at the history, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, but history goes well beyond the 2,000 years since, you know, the church
and
started.
And I'll tell you something else. If you read the Bible, it's not a monotheistic document.
No, it's not. I mean, even the Hebrew translation of the Old Testament, you know, talks totally differently about the whole concept of God. I mean, it speaks in plural. It speaks in, you know, like multiple.
It's a Hebrew document. The whole idea where it's reiterated multiple times in the Hebrew Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, about having one God before me, linguistically, sure. If you read it in the original, presupposes the existence of other gods.
Well, the first creation story in Genesis 1 has multiple deities creating the universe and creating everything, and then Genesis 2 has Yahweh recreating everything as part of the whole. And I always thought that was something that they just absolutely overlooked completely when they were talking about God making everything.
I mean, I'm not a biblical scholar. That is absolutely not my field. But the Bible is not a cohesive document either.
That's true. And, I mean, there are scholars nowadays who say that there were two creation stories overlaid within each other because there were multiple authors of, you know, of the documents. And I think
At different times as well.
Well,
and
I think that that's something that people forget a lot because, I mean, there are certain people who look at the Greek mythology and they say, well, this is the only way that certain gods did things. And then you go, well, no, because you can. There's other authors who wrote totally different stories. I mean, it was all about slash fic. You know, it was like, I like this god, so.
What you had was regional cultures. I mean, we think of ancient Greece, and you know, it was never a coherent nation. You had multiple city-states, and each city-state had its own way of doing things, including expressing religious culture. And that changed over various periods in time. It wasn't a monolithic nation. It was a loosely confederated or sometimes antagonistic group of city-states.
Well,
and
so was the Roman Empire. And then, you know, enter Constantine going, wait, no, this doesn't fucking work. We need to have everyone on the same page so we can control everything better.
And with that said, the one thing I wanted to interject was on Tumblr I saw a comment about how canon Jesus was wonderful, but fanon Jesus was just, you know, you wanted to avoid it at all costs. Okay, so now we've wandered very far afield. A couple of things. Tell us about the Eddas. You mentioned those before. I take it they're really important with the Northern tradition, and just how important are they?
Well, most modern heathens give them a massive amount of authority within the tradition. I think this is misguided. The Eddas are a collection of stories about the Norse gods that were written down by a poet and politician 200 years after the conversion of Iceland.
Oh, so it's pretty much the same thing as like the Mabinogion and the Bhagavad-gita and things like that.
Read them. It's important to know the stories, but understand that you're probably dealing with a document that's heavily influenced by Christian theology. Medieval scholars talk about this with the story of Ragnarok. Mm-hmm. You know, you do not have a clear reflection of what pre-Christian heathens practiced.
Okay.
You know, the ritual of Symbol, where the horn is cast multiple times, and hails are made, the ancestors are hailed, the gods are hailed, and then you can make promises or boast or hail whomever you want. It's a very common heathen ritual. It's taken from one description in Hakon the Good saga. I don't believe it was ever intended to be a religious ritual. I think what's being described in that saga is a feast, period, is a formal feast. I think that we have taken bits and pieces, and rather than depending on actual devotion and engagement with the gods, we get too many people comb through these texts, which, I mean, hey, read them. There's information to be found there. They can provide some useful context. But they take that the way that a Bible, the way that a Baptist would take something in the Bible as holy writ.
Hmm.
So they're very important to modern heathens, but I don't think they should be.
Okay. That's reasonable. Now,
it becomes
ahead.
Another cult of the book kind of thing. And actually, it's kind of interesting because I kind of wonder at times whether or not you, like if you look in the sagas, there are certain ritual celebrations described. And while there's a common thread between them, I'm sure, that we could learn from if we were interested in reconstructing something along that line, I think to take one example as the way that things were done is like taking Sir Gawain and the Green Knight as a literal ritual, you know, structure for the Christmas season.
They don't parse out the influence of culture, of the culture of that time. I don't see that being properly parsed out. And also, when you're dealing with the period of the sagas, you're dealing with a religion that was being superseded by Christianity. It's not a clean source. I tell people, look, connect with your ancestors, connect with your gods, honor them. The ceremonies will come. If you are in right relationship with the holy powers and with your dead, your ceremonies will come. We will find again our songs and rituals.
Absolutely.
And we will find them in an organic way, rooted in devotion, not this incredible self-conscious reconstruction that ultimately I don't believe is sustainable.
It's also self-important, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I
go ahead.
I don't honestly think that it's going to be like a quick thing that happens in one generation. It's going to take, you know, a few generations to reclaim that. You know, because what we lost was multiple generations passing down traditions and devising their own and so on, and not seeing everything as only being...
And that destruction of our ancestral ways did not occur in one moment. It occurred partly by force, yes, but then by a successive cascade of choices. And because this tells us things were not always like they are now. There was a time when people made different devotional choices. And because that was once the case, that tells us that it can be again. We can make different devotional choices. And it's going to be a matter of each person waking up and doing that every damn day. But it's not going to happen all at once. It didn't happen before all at once.
So it's not going to be a simple fix. It's going to be something that's multi-generational to get this corrected.
Exactly.
Well, especially considering that you have traditions of, like, rites of passage that emerged in each, you know, culture, in each spiritual tradition that we don't have today. We're kind of piecing together those kind of things in an attempt to reclaim what took generations to create.
Yeah, and I absolutely, just as a comment, I absolutely hate American culture or Western culture where there's like 12 different things that say that you're an adult. At 13, you pay adult prices at the movies. At 16, 15, you can get your learner's permit. At 16, you can drive. 18, you can have a credit card. You know, I love the concept of one time period in your life. You go through this rebirth and you are an adult from that point on.
About it. Our passages into adulthood now are all rooted in material things that we get. It's not rooted in the development of character or a transition from childhood to adulthood or self-growth and self-awareness. It's all that we do is say you can have this now.
And, well, unless you discount, like, the bar and bat mitzvahs, because that's still pretty, as far as I know, seen as the rite of passage for the Jewish. I would think confirmation would be one for the Catholics. You can't.
If I had
really...
to do my rite of passage, I'd be sending the kids into the woods with a knife.
Yeah.
See, I like that idea.
You challenge your... A rite of passage, I think there should always be a slight chance that you won't make it through. Because otherwise, what's the point? It's not a rite. It's not a ritual.
Exactly
it's not a passage. You're getting something handed to you.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of, you know, handing down tradition multi-generationally is the idea that you, what you do is you prepare these young people by training them with skills they will need for the time when they actually reach the age that they're going to go through this.
Absolutely.
Then you drop them in the middle of nowhere and say, if you make it back, we will welcome you with open arms. But that's going to be part of the...
We're a long way away from that, unfortunately.
Well, we live in this culture that's so scared that children are going to, like, cut their finger or, you know, catch a cold. So we slatted them.
Wait a second. To be fair, that's only really started in the last couple of generations, because I grew up in the generations where you went out and you didn't have safety pads and you fell down on concrete and ripped your knee open and bled for a while. And you played with broken bottles and threw rocks at each other. And, you know, it was all seen in fun.
Absolutely.
It's only been in the last couple of generations that it's been, oh, we must wrap them in bubble wrap and cotton batting to keep them safe from harm.
Well, and I think even worse, it's happened most within the past 20 years, because I can remember as a kid, you know, making cardboard shields with my best friend and just beating the shit out of each other with, like, doweling. And, you know, there was moments I fucking was so into it, I threw my dowel across the yard and hit him in the back, and he couldn't breathe. And we were just like, holy shit, oh my god, he's hurt. And then he fucking chased me down the street with his dowel and tossed it at me. I outran him, but still, this was how we had fun, and there was no fear of that.
You know what it teaches you? It teaches you that you can survive. It teaches you that you can make your way in the world, and that sometimes you'll have to face challenges, but there you can find solutions. It teaches you not to fold at the first sense of challenge. I teach young people. I gotta tell you, they have no idea now, as a group, there's no comprehension of what to do when something is hard.
Well, it's all about self-esteem nowadays, right? There's no challenge in that, you know.
Self-esteem comes from learning how to do things well. Self-esteem comes from pushing yourself and overcoming challenges.
Absolutely.
It doesn't come from being given a gold star for showing up.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Yeah, we've gone over that in other shows, too. You know, the second place person is the first loser, you know. So you have, you know, success and failure, and it teaches you that, you know, it's okay to fail as long as you just keep trying.
My students are so afraid of making a mistake, and I tell them, like, get used to it. You're going to, and you know what? Then you've got to sort it out, and you'll learn better because you made the mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It's a valuable and essential part of learning, and I think that comes with learning how to be a decent human being, too.
I think it was Edison that said something along the lines of the light bulb didn't just come. It was I had 100 failures and 100 ways not to do it or something, you know, and it was cool.
Einstein said once, he's like, I'm not really smarter than anybody else. I just stick with problems longer.
Outstanding. All right, we've got about 14 minutes left. Our show next week is going to be on runes. So since that is so impacting in the Northern traditions, you have anything you want to say about them?
They're a living family of spirits. And they're not human. They never were human. They're relatively amoral by our standards. They need to be engaged with as though you were dealing with an elite team of mercenaries. You pay them, they will do. Take the time to develop the relationship and do not get in their debt. I've written on runes. You're dealing with a family of spirits. You're engaging with a family of spirits, and they are incredibly powerful. And look what Odin had to do to gain the runes.
That's very true.
Nine nights and days, possibly dying on Yggdrasil, on the tree of sacrifice.
And he gave up
and engaging with the runes.
Most people nowadays wouldn't give up $5 to gain knowledge like that. Odin sacrificed an eye and hung on a tree. I mean, who's going to do that now?
Tell me about one of the things that we will be discussing is the concept of the blank rune. Do you have anything?
It's nonsense. Odin did not hang on the tree for a blank rune. This is Ralph fucking Blum. I would like to take a stick to that man.
Well, tell us how you really feel.
Nonsense. There is no blank rune.
Okay. But you were talking about the concept of weird, and since that is supposedly the blank rune, wouldn't
it's
that...
It's not. Weird can show up in tetra, and if you're using the younger Futhark, it can show up in a couple of combinations. Mostly it's tetra. If you have weird coming up, you can get a combination of runes. Probably tetra is going to be in there. If you get a question coming up where you need to stop asking, and you're using the younger Futhark, you'll probably get the rune Gar. There is no blank rune. It was an invention of some New Age twit, Ralph Blum.
Oh, yeah.
And no reputable rune master works with the blank rune. It's nonsense.
Huh.
It's true. Actually,
it's a whole spot for any rune worker. Right now, I have no blank rune.
I just picked up a set of runes on Amazon not long ago, actually, because I was kind of wanting to refresh my memory about using them again. And it came with a blank rune, but the book says, like, there, so if you lose a rune, you can replace
it.
Because, like...
That's what I do. When I get a set, if I don't make my own, which I often don't, because I suck at that, but if I get a blank rune, I just tuck it aside, because sooner or later you're going to lose one or one will break.
It's true. It's like Scrabble. I mean, shit, they should give you more little tiles. You know, if you're going to lose an A, you're fucked. Like... So that's the way it should be with blank
languages. I used to play with my adopted mom. She spoke 7 languages. We would play. I can read, like, 3, sometimes 4 if I really give myself a headache. We would play in, like, 5 or 6 languages. Oh, it was fun. But
I
want to
play Scrabble with you. That would be fucking hilarious. That would be awesome.
My game is
Yeah. Now we're going to play in Latin.
Oh, Latin's good for all the Q words.
Yeah, except there's only, like, what, 1 Q, 2 Qs in the damn thing? How are you going to play Latin Scrabble? Seriously. Every word branches off
you
the
Q. You need more Qs if you're going to just play in Latin. But when you're stuck and you only have a Q, it comes in handy.
Well, then you take all of the superfluous Us and use them as Qs because they don't have Us, they have Vs.
But how are you going to play... Like, okay, let's take Scrabble in Hawaiian. You need more vowels.
I don't know Hawaiian, so I can't help you there.
But, I mean, it would be fun to play, except that Scrabble just doesn't come equipped for all those different languages. I think that's
something it doesn't. Like I said, my favorite name is Chet.
Oh, that'll work.
If I have a choice of if I'm going to play a game, it's probably going to be Chet.
Okay, last 10 minutes. What are you working on now, Galena?
Oh, wow.
Writing books.
Right. I've got a devotional anthology to Loki and Segan that I'm working on, and I'm currently teaching a couple of online classes. I've got one starting tonight, actually, on honoring the ancestors, and it walks people through the basic steps of developing an ancestor practice. And in January, I'm starting a course on developing a devotional practice. My partner's starting one on developing a devotional practice to Dionysus. And there are a couple of other colleagues. I posted about it on my blog that have really good courses going. So I've been kind of working on my online courses lately because several people, every so often I get people asking for them.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a course that I want to run in January as well on dealing with the evil eye, Malopio. But the developing a devotional practice and the ancestor piece are my big ones right now. Got the devotional to Loki and Segan coming out. It's in the works now. Eventually I'm going to do a book on developing an ancestor practice, but I'm kind of in the middle of that. I'm working with Bibliotheca Alexandrina to do a devotional to the Greek god Charon, paying off the debt. Yeah, so if anyone listening venerates Charon or would like to contribute, check out my blog or shoot me an email at craftova@gmail.com and we'll talk. What else? I'm working slowly but surely on a devotional to the Norse god Mani, our god of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Those are probably my biggest projects right now.
That sounds great. You want to promote any of your books while you got an open mic?
Well, I just came out with 2 new ones. One is called He is Frenzy, and to the best of my ability, it is a collection of everything that I've written to Odin about Odin thus far. I think I left one or two things out accidentally, but I mean, I've written a lot about Odin, so y'all just have to deal with that. And that's available on Amazon.com. It's called He is Frenzy. And then I kept getting pushed by various people to publish my master's thesis. So I put that out under the title of Transgressing Faith, Race, Gender, and the Problem of Ergi in Modern Heathenry. Ergi is a Norse term that means unmanliness, and it implies gender transgression. So, and I talk about the development of modern heathenry historically in the U.S., and then I talk about ritual performativity and the problem of gender transgression and how that's dealt with in the community and why the community might see it as a problem. I don't, but, you know, mm-hmm. I talk about gender transgressiveness and the issue of gender and race in the development of contemporary heathenry. And that was also available on Amazon. I'm doing a lot of art recently. Like, I just had my first gallery show, so I'm selling a lot of my paintings online on my website. There's a gallery page. And I did a book of photography called Numinous Places, which you can also pick up at blurb.com. But wow. You can get it off my site as well. So I'm kind of playing with a lot of different things.
Sounds
probably
great.
Probably got another thing that's coming out. Yeah, and trying to work toward a PhD. So
outstanding. Wow,
that
sounds really,
really cool.
Great. Yeah. I'm going to link all of her her Amazon page to the description of this, as well as her website and her blog. So if you're listening to this on Blog Talk, come to magicalmusings.net and take a look and find those references. I want to thank Galena for joining us this evening, and it was really informative and really fascinating and really just out there. Oh, no, this was actually a normal show because the people get, you know, way, way out there.
Yes.
It was fun. I enjoyed this one. I enjoy talking about this stuff.
We may have to have you on for the runes.
I'd love to have you on for more shows. I mean, we could go off on tangents for hours if you're into it.
I would be willing to do it again, absolutely. Next week is finals week for me, so I will not be sane. But after the holidays, I'd be happy to come back on.
Oh, outstanding.
Awesome.
We may have to shoot you an email.
Email with the link to the show once you post it.
Oh, definitely. Oh, most definitely. Yeah, that's one of the things that I was going to do. Like we said, next week's show is going to be about runes. It's not just going to be about the Futhark runes, but it's also going to be about the Agam. We're going to talk a little bit about both of them so we can see the interplay between not only the runes themselves, but between the sets of runes and then the magic with the runes. So tune in for that. It sounds like it's going to be a good show. MagicalMusings.net is the website. Joy at MagicalMusings.net or Brian at MagicalMusings.net if you want to get in touch with us. Or if you have any questions or comments or anything like that, audience participation is key, and we do want to hear from you guys. So hopefully that's it.
And, yeah, if you guys want to hit us up on Tumblr, we both have blogs there as well. Joy's is wide-worlds-joy.tumblr.com. Mine is cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com. You can message us there if you want. Follow us, you know, whatever. Interact with us. We are people. We have things to say. You've heard us talk already.
All right. Y'all have a good evening.
Have a good night, folks.
Have a good night, guys.
Thank you very much.